everyone, and thanks for joining us for another episode of LID Radio Podcast. I'm your host for today, Francesca, and for this episode, we hear from Stephen D'Souza and Kuyen Bui about their book, Not Being, The Art of Self-Transformation. Stephen is an executive educator, coach, and keynote speaker. He has authored or co-authored 5 books, Made in Britain, Brilliant Networking, Not Knowing, Not Doing, and Not Being. Stephen has been recognised by the Thinkers 50 on its radar list and was included in HR Magazine's Most Influential list. His work has been featured in national and international media, including Harvard Business Review, the BBC, The Independent, The Guardian, and The Sunday Times. Kuyen is an author, speaker, and sought-after facilitator who guides individuals and organisations to uncover the goodness that is already there. At university, he studied computer science and philosophy. He thrives on bringing analytical rigour into his inquiries of human messiness. Kuyen enjoys writing and storytelling and has won several awards, notably the Peter Drucker Challenge Essay Award and the Moth Boston Story Slam Award. So about the book Not Being. For too long, we have bought into the myth of separation, the story that we each win or lose through the relentless pursuit of self-improvement, achieving personal and organisational goals, and increasing consumerism. This has led us to be more lonely, exhausted, and disconnected than ever, with a devastating impact on our personal lives, families, communities, organisations, and the planet. Not Being invites us to be curious about a different way of life, where we are interconnected, interdependent with each other and our environment, no longer fragmented but whole. It invites us to transition from a selfie culture to a selfless one that is radically inclusive of the other. We need to relinquish narrow ideas about who we are to discover and embrace a wider identity. We are part of something much bigger than us. All right, well, thank you so much for joining us today. Can you both explain a little bit about what readers can learn from the book and why you wrote it?
Yes, thank you, Francesca. Maybe I can start and Kuyen, please build on this answer. Francesca, for too long, I think we've bought into this myth, and this is the myth of separation. And underlying that, it's a story that we each win or lose according to our own personal and achieving our own personal and organizational goals. And this is sometimes portrayed in this almost like relentless pursuit of self-improvement. And you can see that in much of the personal development for sure, but even in the business literature around hustling or always this endless growth. And that has led to increasing consumerism, but on a personal level, it's also led to people feeling more exhausted, disconnected, and lonelier than ever. And it has an impact not just on our personal lives, but on our families, our communities, the organization, and of course, on our planet. So this book was really an opportunity to be curious about a different way of life, not emphasizing our individuality or our separation, but instead the interconnectedness and interdependency we have with each other and our environment. And almost like to transition from having almost a selfie culture to becoming a more selfless one that's more inclusive of others. So the foundation of this was really working at the level of identity rather than just on actions and thinking again about who do we think we are and embracing a wider identity of something that's bigger than any one of us alone. So I'll hand over to Kuyen just to build on that further.
Mm. Thank you, Stephen. Yeah, and I also wanted to add that this also goes beyond who we think we are. And we can easily get into the thinking and the argument about who we think we are, but I think the book, we even call them pointers. We point to the experience of ourselves that is in a way beyond what we can even think or what we can even imagine. I think that's one very important message that we want to have. It's beyond what we can think. And also just another note that when Stephen mentioned that it goes beyond the individuality, we do not want to deny it. we do not want to deny that there's a person. It's just that we want to reimagine it. And this book is an invitation, like Stephen said, that curiosity to examine the sense of self. And we did write with our own inquiry and our own experiences in that too. And it has been, we hope to share that journey with the readers.
Fantastic. I mean, I suppose this is a question more for Stephen, but I just wanted to ask how this book complements the other books that you've written, so Not Doing and Not Knowing as well.
Yes, the first two books were written with Diana Renner, the co-author of Not Knowing and Not Doing. So Not Knowing really started, Francesca, from this experience of almost struggle with the unknown, but recognizing that it wasn't the same as uncertainty. So often you see business books that talk about managing uncertainty or leading in uncertainty. But uncertainty is only one feeling in response to the unknown. And it's not the only response. So you think about children at Christmas or Eid or Diwali or festival, they might have a present that's wrapped up. Now, the child doesn't feel uncertain about what's in the present. They may feel curious. They may feel full of wonder, excitement, possibility. So we became very curious ourselves about people who relate to the unknown, not as a place of uncertainty, but as a space of opportunity. So we started to interview all sorts of people, from entrepreneurs, artists, adventurers, scientists. And what we discovered was that it wasn't adding more tools to their toolkit. It was actually about what we called negative capabilities. And that's about the ability to unlearn rather than to add more. And so the trilogy started with looking at our approach to and our over-reliance on expertise and balancing that with our emphasis on curiosity and on imagination and with our ability to tolerate and to look at the unknown in a productive way. Then moved on from the mindset of being able to work with and live in the unknown and not knowing to our actions. So we live in a society that privileges action and has an overemphasis on overaction. And we can see the results of this in terms of burnout, exhaustion, quick fixes. So the second book in the trilogy, Not Doing, was looking at how do we have sustainable action, or in the phrase that we used on the subtitle, effortless action. And that means stopping pushing or pulling, but working more with the context and the environment. And it was very much paying attention to small things. For example, pausing, using solitude, embracing stillness, and finding ways that we can still be effective, but we don't need to do that from a place that leaves us disconnected. So this book, Not Being, completes the trilogy of what leaders need to know, do, and be by offering an alternative to the prevailing discourse in the fields of leadership, management, and also personal development. So it goes beneath the surface to see who are we being that's creating these results, and offers an alternative view for leaders to take forward, or readers to take forward in their own lives.
And I think it's probably especially relevant now. I think with what's been happening over the past year or two with the pandemic, this has kind of been what people are saying is one of the biggest times that people have been able to sit back and really think about themselves and kind of the individual and the world around them. I wonder if you agree, if you think, you know, this actually could, the timing couldn't really be better.
Yes, I'll say a few words and Korean, please come in. But I think we're definitely in a period of time when people have been disrupted. So their normal way of life has been punctuated. And all of us at some level were not able to continue our lives as they were before the pandemic. And we talked about going to a new normal and doing differently. But in order to do differently, many of us found ourselves questioning questions around our purpose, questions around what gives us meaning in this context, and thinking, how do we live our lives differently? Or what is the way that we wish to live our lives differently? So this book offers a deeper reflection, not just about doing better, but being differently, or being differently in the world. And I think that's why it's more prescient, because these anomalies our lives aren't only about global events, but that in many occasions in our lives, we have fractures, or what we in the book called times when things fall apart, meaning times of transition and change. And it offers almost a critical way to look at this and to maximize those opportunities rather than dismissing them or being at the vicissitudes and the mercy of them. But I'll hand over to Kuyen just to share your reflections, Kuyen, because I know you're going through reiterations of the pandemic still in Vietnam. So it's very much a live situation.
Yeah. And it's, thank you. The pandemic is a big wave right now. And I'm also reflecting on what you said about not doing. And this is a time where it's not just that the thing that we have been doing, we can't do it anymore. It's also that the kind of person we have been cannot be that way anymore. And I think one of the things that I know struck many people, and we did write that in the book, the experience of facing mortality. Well, perhaps not in our own personal life. Some people do go through illnesses, but this time, like almost everybody we know somebody who's affected and whose life are affected by what's happening, and then that really forces asking the questions of who am I and who should I be in this time. And I also find that many people, like Stephen, you said, asking about their meaning and purpose, and also asking how did all these things come about, and perhaps the way we see, the way we experience ourselves is there's something about that is missing. And I think I agree with you that the things so apart is an opportunity, and it usually has been very much repressed. It's just think about the word things falling apart. It generally has very negative connotation. And I think that that what we want to change in perception is that it doesn't have to be that way. Things falling apart doesn't have to be something really terrible, even though it might seem at first.
No, I think that Kuyen has given a brilliant answer. And we look at we look at different models of when things fall apart. And to Kuyen's point, they're not all negative. We change, for example, when we become parents, for example, motherhood. And we look at the metaphor of motherhood as well as suffering. We look at the metaphor of leadership. Perhaps we'll explore that further in this podcast. But our lives are always in transition. But it's how do we relate to that transition, and how do we use these transition points in our lives and leverage them to grow? And so that's really one of the core themes of this book.
Definitely. I mean, one of the interesting parts for me was a bit called Beware the Ego Trap. And I think ego is something really interesting, and everyone tends to be quite interested in it, obviously, because it relates to them. And I think having a big ego is something you see and hear about quite a lot in business. There's always sort of articles on, you know, how to avoid big egos in the office. But I just wanted to ask really how people start to harness a healthy ego and sense of self, which you go into in the book.
Yes, it's a good question. What we do in the book is we look at the origins of this idea of ego, and we see it as one of the symptoms of separation, and this idea that we constantly need to compare and base our sense of self-worth on others. So, for example, this sort of originates even from our childhood, when we find ourselves in competitive environments in the classroom or the sports field, where people are segregated into fast sets or lower sets. And this idea that we derive our worth by how we believe that we're perceived by others. So in the book, we give the example of Adam Grant, the organizational psychologist. He posted a tweet, and it was in October 2020, but he said the root of insecurity is craving the approval of others. But that gives us them the power to inflate or deflate our self-esteem. A sense of self-worth comes from putting identity above image and worrying less about what others think of us than what we think of ourselves. So our research showed that most of us, we're always looking at constantly, whether it's overt or subtle, how do we compare with others? And to the extreme, we can look at sociopathy, and we talk about the research of John Ronson, who wrote The Psychopath Test. Said CEOs are four times more likely to be sociopaths than the population in general. But what we came to this idea is that you can have a healthy ego, and it's not about removing the ego. It's recognizing that you're either in a state of recognizing it's true confidence rather than overconfidence, but it's not having a deflated ego either. So there's inflated ego. It's when we tend to go towards grandiosity and we tend to be overconfident. But deflated ego, on the other hand, is also a form of egotism. It's when we put ourselves lower and don't acknowledge our intrinsic self-worth. So we're almost diminishing ourselves as and not recognizing our true capabilities. So you could see this in the form of humble bragging. You know, when people receive awards, I don't deserve to win this. But obviously they're still bragging at the same time. So the ability to have a healthy ego, we use the example in the book of the Prime Minister of New Zealand, Jacinda Ardern, when the Muslim mosque was attacked in March 2019. Rather than just come up with a divisive response, as many would have seen in other countries, perhaps maybe anti-Muslim rhetoric, she came up with a very human, sincere response in which she engaged with the community. She demonstrated compassion. She wore the hijab. She even refused to speak the name of the culprit, but she was quick to take action and quick to show that she could respond in a healthy way rather than grandiose or going to the opposite, which is the deflated ego. I'll just let Kuyen build on that sense about healthy ego.
Yeah, and the idea of the ego is much even older than psychology as we know in the Western world. And you know, in many wisdom traditions around the world, there's always sayings about there's something beyond the ego. It's like the example Stephen gave. And there's a different, it's not even a different part of us, like a different capacity to respond to any situation that doesn't base on this limited, separate self-interest. The thing that we have been taught in school that we are rational, self-interested creatures. You know, there's more to us than just that, and I think that's what we are aiming to with the idea of the healthy ego. And it's not. We also do not want to portray that as a virtue, and then okay, now this is the new good thing that you should try to become, because the whole idea of not being, when what I love about when Stephen first told me about the idea is that it is a complementary approach to the becoming somebody pressure that many of us feel very prevalent, becoming somebody. And this is like, it's a different approach. It's that, it doesn't have to be just about becoming somebody, even though that's important. There can be more than that. And I think that's what we are aiming at with this idea of not being, and we call it a healthy ego. Yeah,
and I think ego is something that, and like a sense of self is obviously something you hear a lot about in business. And something interesting you go into, sort of related to that, is leadership in the book. You talk about an identity shift that comes when you become a leader. So I was wondering if you could explain why this is important for a leader and what that identity shift tends to be.
Yes, in the book, we look at leadership as one of the ways that we change our identity. So, for example, when we take a leadership responsibility in the workplace, we're no longer an individual contributor, but now representing something bigger, like enabling, facilitating, and caring for others. And it becomes even more significant when we move from leading, a small team to leading a function, or imagine leading an entire organization. So our contrast is, it's not just adopting a different style of leadership, but it's also requiring a transitional shift in how we view ourselves and who we are for others. So in the book, we give the example of Lynn Sedgmore, OBE, who was a college principal. So she was responsible for 30,000 higher education students. And then she was offered a role as a CEO of a Centre for Excellence in Leadership within the UK. And although she was a high performer in her previous role, she found she wasn't succeeding in her new role, which was less a closely knit organisation that tended to value her, but more a fragmented and disparate organisation. So we give the example, there's a quote by Frances Hesselbein, who was the CEO of the Girl Scouts in the US. She said, leadership is much less about what you do and more about who you are. If you view leadership as a bag of manipulative tricks or charismatic behaviors to advance your personal interest, then people have a right to be cynical. But if your leadership flows first and foremost from your inner character and integrity of ambition, then you can justly ask people to lend themselves to your organization and its mission. So Lynn found herself trying some of her old tricks, but finding that they were not working, and recognizing that she needed to change her beliefs around a model that she had about leadership as almost like a mothering style, caring and tending, and to being more of a stewardship style, in which she didn't necessarily have all the right answers, but she could embrace, in her case, she could embrace the not knowing, and she could move more from being in charge, but recognizing she's not in control, but have the courage and humility to work under those circumstances. So she gives a brilliant example of how in a coaching relationship, she felt liberated because she knew she no longer had to have all the answers, but she could shift her perspective and who she was as a leader to embracing more this space of not knowing. I'll let Kuyen just build on that in terms of leadership.
Yeah, and I just wanted to say that Lynn's story was just astounding in terms of how she used the word expansion to describe her sense of self. That was the experience of her when she felt liberated. This a sense of expansion that is, she felt like she's no longer who she was. In that sense of expansion, I just wanted to mention a very important point, that this is a process of it is a result of an intense process of work for introspection, and also working with a coach for her in order to let go of her very glorious past, and just imagine how difficult it was for someone to be playing the role of a mother-like figure for an organization and has received all the accolades and appreciation and admiration and the sense of achievement from that, and having to let all of that go. And that was a very, very challenging process for Lynn to let that go. And so, yeah, I just wanted to say that journey is, different stages to it, and it has very unique and specific challenges. It's like, it's not a doing. It's not a doing, like Stephen said, it's not a doing for sure.
Absolutely. I mean, the book, it covers so many different areas of business, to be honest, but one that is particularly relevant, considering, as we've said, the global pandemic, is innovation. So thinking differently, adapting to the world around you. And there's a section on reinventing through creative destruction. And I thought it'd be great to hear what your thoughts were on this, because, you know, as a phrase, it sounds, you know, quite terrifying, destruction. But it's a really interesting point you make. So it'd be great to hear your thoughts.
Yes, the phrase creative destruction, it was coined by Joseph Schumpeter, who was an Austrian economist. And he really took the metaphor from manufacturing, where he was describing that for more productive methods to come into place, you needed to dismantle established processes and ways of working. So it just wasn't in the world of manufacturing in terms of processes and procedures. But he also challenged the idea that we also need to change our thinking, and we need to challenge our assumptions and we need to let go of old assumptions in order for new things to happen. So you can think about this in terms of, let's say, simple example, now the Olympics has happened in Japan, Special Olympics now, but the high jump was done in a very particular way where people would face on and try to jump over the bar, and really they reached a limit. And then Fosby changed the thinking and he attempted to jump over the bar backwards. But in order to do that, he needed to challenge assumptions about this is how this event is done. The same with the assumptions around what's possible to run a mile within 4 minutes, challenged by Roger Bannister. But the same idea is in organizations, that when organizations are established, they have a core purpose, yet society changes around them. So how does an organization have an ability to make a shift? So, and to move also with the circumstances. So we can think of one of a well-known organization, IBM. It's been around for over 100 years, but started initially as an organization that was looking at mechanical waiting and timekeeping devices, yet was able to shift by to obviously mainframes and hardware, then to software, then to consulting, and now is in operating in the world of cloud, AI, and infrastructure. So it's able to take what it seemed as foundational assumptions at what is its core business and able to shift with those times. And that's not just at an organizational level, but that's also at a personal level. So if we think about change being on an S-curve, so people adopt things very slowly, then there tends to be a high growth spurt and then a decline. How are we personally recognizing when are we able to make shifts, not just when things are in decline, when we're no longer performing or when our business is doing badly, but are we able to reinvent ourselves when things are going well? They could get better, but we're able to take a long-term view. So reinvention is about recognizing those weak signals and being able to pivot, reappraise, and shift in order to do that. So we do have a personal story in the book, but I'll hand over to Kuyen just to share a bit more around reinvention.
Yeah, I love what you said about we notice these weak signals, not only when things go bad, but even when things are good. We didn't mention the improv, the theater practices. There's an idea ending on a high note. So at the scene where you the audience laugh, you really deliver the beautiful moment, and then that ends instead of ending on a low note. And I find that very relevant to the personal context, is that we usually think we change when we hit a dead end and we need to try something new. But here we also look at the moments of unexpected successes or surprises, and use that as a investigation to do what is possible. And one of the idea that we do put forward in this is the importance of play. Especially adults are free from expectation of how things should turn out to be, or how we should turn out to act or to be. And it is very, very important that adults are able to play. We did bring up the idea of identity play, especially for people who are contemplating or are in actual transition, to be able to play with multiple roles and different possibility of what kind of thing they can do and who's the kind of person they can be. Very, very necessary. And like Stephen said, we can't wait until we are done with one track to begin playing. It has to be built into our current day-to-day operation, so to speak. Is there anything you want to add?
No, I think that's right, Kuyen. And one of the people is Anil Seth, who's a professor of cognitive and computational neuroscience at the University of Sussex. And one of his main points is that the self is a process of construction, and it's not an identity to be preserved at all costs. And so he really highlights the liability when we, when leaders or when individuals, we have a fixed sense of our identity, because then it makes us unable to respond to or reinvent ourselves. So we see that often in this idea of the fixed mindset with Carol Dweck's research on growth. And it's more around how do we recognize that, yes, we have patterns which may be developed over time. We use the metaphor of grooves caused by the river. I think it was from Margaret Heffernan in her book, Willful Blindness. But the idea that we have this plasticity, that we can change, we can learn new habits, and our identity is not something that's solid, but something that can be moved and malleable with our context, with our environment.
Yeah. And I just also want to add, since you speak about the malleable identity, we did bring up this this practice from a British consultant, Charles Davies. He calls it the identity yoga. And the idea is really being able to take our sense of self and being able to notice that it doesn't have to be that way all the time, and being able to stretch it and then to twist it and to get into different shape with it, with the different questions, different methodologies to get into a more fluid, more malleable, and more fitting sense of identity. Is something that could be very, very relevant to people looking into this topic of personal and organizational reinvention.
Absolutely. I mean, innovation is so often linked with creativity. They go hand in hand. I'm wondering if you think that some people have a creative or innovative bone in them and some people don't, or if you feel like it is something that's inside everyone.
My own perspective is that creativity is inside everyone. It's something that we're born with. It's something that we do every day in terms of responding to our environment. But often we tend to conflate creativity with being an artist, i.e. painting, writing, drawing. But if we see that every act is almost like a creative response to our environment, then we can acknowledge that we all are creative, and we all embody creativity every day in all our relationships, in all our undertakings. So I think we need to reclaim the concept of creativity, and not to narrow it to certain individuals or certain ways of expressing it.
Yeah. And it's quite sad, actually, to think about how some people have learned that they are not creative. That's really sad to think about. And I wholeheartedly agree that. And I'm one of those in recovery who never thought that I was a creative person. You know, I would train in computer science and philosophy. I never thought that I am a creative person. But I think more and more the process of unlearning and of rediscovery is that, as Stephen said, it doesn't mean that I have to put the label artist on me. It is noticing that we make things in our life. You make tiny dish, you make a small game, you make a little gathering with friends. All of these things that act up putting things together, and this is creativity. And it's very tempting to overlook those small things and then disregard ourselves and disregard our potential by just saying, well, I'm not creative.
I think previously, it's been seen as something you either have or you don't. So no, it's interesting to hear your thoughts on that. Moving on to a slightly different topic, but it's obviously quite a big one at the moment. So in the world we live in, diversity and inclusion, it's never been more important than now and carefully considered, especially by businesses. And even though there's a long way to go, there seems to be developments in this area across the world. But one phrase that has been developed from D&I, diversity and inclusion, is diversity, inclusion and belonging. And you do talk about it in the book, including that belonging section. So why is belonging so important, especially in business? But how can businesses kind of address this and start to look at it?
Yeah, we can take a wider societal view, as you say, Francesca. So we talk about in 2020, the WHO estimates that 264 million people of all ages across the globe suffer from depression. and that there is a link, although there's many causes or that correlate to depression. One of the ideas is around this sense of disconnection from others. And that's been explored by the journalist Johan Harry in his book Lost Connections, but also by Olivia Lang. She wrote a book called The Lonely City, in which she described in modern cities this absence or paucity of connection, closeness and kinship. In our book, we describe the research done by the former Surgeon General of the United States, Vivek Murthy, who wrote a book called Together. He describes how, even though he was in a very successful role, he always suffered from an acute sense of loneliness during his childhood, feeling unworthy of love, a lack of belonging. And the public health implications on this are profound. He said it can reduce an individual's lifespan in the same way that smoking 15 cigarettes a day can. And there's obviously correlations to developing heart disease, hypertension, strokes, and dementia even. So although we're in a society that we have, you know, obviously social media and online connections, paradoxically, many of us feel more lonely and disconnected than ever. So it really is an epidemic of disconnection and a lack of sense of belonging. And that may be because of our globalized society, that technology has replaced face-to-face connections. We can see that in the pandemic with the rise of Zoom, and in turn with that Zoom fatigue, where we talk about this almost disconnection. You can see somebody, but you can't quite feel them. It leaves us more tired and less connected than we would like, even though obviously we want to also highlight the benefits of technology. What we talk about in the book is a case of an individual who created and was able to create belonging, having come over to the UK as a refugee. His name is Kenny Marmela de Cruz. And he experienced a sense of being disconnected, not feeling at home, and various health maladies as a result. But what he was able to do was to recognize the importance of belonging and create almost like a group for men to come together and to share their stories. And often the rates of suicide are much higher with young men in particular, because they're not able to convey some of these feelings. And he accounts many stories around the globe, but where it's enabled people to almost, he says, you know, some people have reported to him, save their lives, that critical. Now, organizations have recognized this because, as you know, that becoming with home working more disconnected. So how they recognize the importance of creating a sense of community and creating a sense of belonging. So you can see this in, we used to have a hot desk idea where people would come in and just use the desk on the day, but that took away their sense of having a place, having a space. So again, how can organizations allow people to curate again, to feel a sense of belonging? The growth in organizations of employee resource groups. So for example, if there's networks for women or networks for different groups to feel that sense of, I'm not alone here, there's somebody like me. And the rise of employee engagement. So an organization called Gallup that looks at engagement, one of their questions is, do you have a best friend at work? And the importance of that question to signify a sense of belonging and a sense of feeling at home, critical to employee engagement. So all of these things together can lead to a sense of purpose, can lead to a sense of being at home, can lead to a sense of belonging, but critical to organizational life, but also our personal lives. Just let Kuyin to build on this.
Yeah, and one more thing about one way to look at this, the rise for this almost craving for belonging, and then it's really becoming a very, very popular term these days in the context of organizations, is that it's a response to the otherwise emphasis on the individual. If all the stress and the potential achievement is put on the individual, then why do you need belonging? why do people care about belonging so much now? And to me, it is a very positive sign that there is a part of the person, of the individual that knows that we are not just the individual for whom all the stress and all the expectation and all the achievement would be laid upon. We are also part of community, part of larger society and all that. So yeah, yes to this craving for belonging, and that might be a good thing. That is saying something very fundamental about us. And just one last thing, and here's something that I learned in the process of writing this, is the word belonging quite literally can be understood as belong for. So longing is a verb. So yeah, the question then becomes, who longs for me? Who longs for me? Is this place, is this community, is this organization, is there anyone there longs for me? Would I be missed when I'm gone? And it is a real, very personal, heartfelt questions to ask when we ask the question of belonging. And the example Stephen gave about Kenny, I think he really was able to create and foster that sense of belonging to the point where his absence will be missed and other people's absence will be missed. And I think that's just a really beautiful example of belonging is something to be fostered, to be recognized, to be cultivated, especially in modern times.
Yeah, and just to build on that, at one level, what the heart of this book is the idea that we aren't separate, you know, and ultimately that we do belong. And how we recognize that is when we reflect on who we are. So we talk about the biology of interconnection. We talk about the science of our interconnectedness. For example, 37 trillion cells that are in our body, most of them are non-human DNA, how we're literally exchanging with our environment, almost like porous to our environment in the exchange of molecules, in the exchange of atoms. That this idea that we're disconnected, that we can be separate and solipsistic, is in essence a fallacy, that we are at heart, at the very heart of who, what it means to be human, is it means to belong. And one of the things we hope that is when people read this book, they get a sense of that belonging. And when we have that sense of coming home and belonging, it takes away some of our almost incessant desire to grow, to be someone, in order to fill that that gap or that hole with that emptiness. So I think that's the main challenge of this book, is really going to the challenging our identity of this separation. And I think that'll be valuable whether you're an entrepreneur, you're a business leader, you're working in the home, but just to give you a new perspective on both work, professional life, but also for your personal life too.
Yeah, and sort of now we've gone through the question, it's really clear to see those themes coming through really strongly of sort of belonging, sense of self, identity. It gives us a really good idea of the book and what to expect as well. So for anyone interested in knowing more about both of you and your work, where can they find you online and more about you?
For myself, Francesca, they can visit stephendesouza.com. That's my name, and just .com, where there's a website with access information about the trilogy, but also previous books, one called Made in Britain, looking at diversity and role models in Britain, and another book on networking and social capital networks and develop your social capital.
Yeah, likewise for me, my website is at kuenbui.com, so kuenbui.com. And yeah, you can find out about all the projects that I am involved in. And I'm primarily speaking and writing in Vietnamese right now, but that might change in the future with the publish of this book. So
amazing. Brilliant. We'll include all the links as well to your websites in the show notes, so everyone can click directly through from there as well. Brilliant. Well, thank you so much to both of you for joining us.
Thank you, Francesca.
Thank you, Kian.
Thank you so much for listening, and do remember to keep an eye on our social media at Lid Publishing on Facebook, Twitter and Instagram, and at Lid Business Media on LinkedIn, where we'll be sharing more podcasts, books and expert opinions from people such as Stephen and Queen. Take care and see you next time on Lid Radio Podcast.